Welcome to Let's Talk ETFs. I'm your host, Jonathan Liss, and I've been closely tracking the ETF space for more than 13 years through a variety of roles here at SeekingAlpha.com. Each week, a different guest and I will take an in-depth look at a particular aspect of the rapidly evolving exchange-traded fund space, with a focus on how investors can best utilize ETFs to reach their investing goals. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. This podcast is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Nothing said here should be taken as investment advice. All opinions expressed on this show are those of the individuals expressing them alone. A full set of disclosures will be included at the end of this show. You can subscribe to Let's Talk ETFs on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. For reference purposes, this podcast is being recorded on the morning of Tuesday, February 2nd, 2021. My guest today is Tony Campos, Head of Sustainable Investment Americas, FTSE Russell. Tony leads the sustainable investing business and product development in the Americas region, working closely with FTSE Russell's asset manager and asset owner clients. Tony joined the company in 2004, and prior to his current role, managed the global ESG research and engagement programs for the FTSE for Good Index series. He holds a BA from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and has a Level 3 certificate in investment management from the CFA Society of the UK. All right, let's get into it, Tony. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Jonathan.
Sure. And amazingly, even though this is somewhere in the mid-70s in terms of the number of episodes that that we've done here, we have not done anything dedicated to ESG yet. I've been looking for the right person to do it, and I think you're actually the perfect person to be able to have this conversation. So I think the timing is really great, particularly with a new administration, which I think is friendlier to many of the concepts in ESG. So thank you for being able to join me on relatively short notice here, and I'm expecting a great conversation.
My pleasure. Happy to be the first to talk ESG.
Yes. So I guess before we get into the actual ESG conversation, I'd love it if you could tell our listeners a bit about yourself. When did you first become interested in investing broadly? And then how did you become drawn to sustainable investing in particular?
Yeah, sure. I mean, always an interesting place to start. So, as you mentioned in the intro, I started work here in 2004. So, you know, we're coming up around 17 years for myself in this business. And that was really right out of college for me. So my interest in investing and sustainability was certainly geared more towards sustainability than investing at that point in my life. And what really interested me about working at FTSE, I actually started in London. I was based there for the first 11 years of my career, was the idea that sustainability and investing could come together to try to influence company behavior and influence company practices, you know, for the better. For me, that meant for the first few years of my work, I was focused on company engagement, which is, you know, about reaching out to the companies that are part of, in the case of FTSE Russell, our indexes, around the rules and methodologies for how we rate companies and how we create indices using those ratings related to ESG issues. So it was a very interesting experience to be able to sort of have some conversations with various, not just companies, but different divisions, departments, senior leadership across companies are about sustainability issues.
And I guess this is as good a place as any to start at the very beginning of the ESG story. So what are the origins of ESG investing? I have to imagine back in 2004, this was a much less well-known or popular story than it's become in the ensuing almost two decades.
Certainly true. And, you know, the story here, I think, you know, goes back even well before 2004 and certainly my time involved in the industry. In fact, the term ESG wasn't really even around at that time, I recall, when starting. But if we want to kind of trace the roots back, I think, you know, there's a particular dimension here that sort of historically was referred to as ethical investing or social responsible investing, which was really driven by a niche segment of investors that wanted to align their portfolios with their ethical or religious beliefs. Where that started to take a more sort of meaningful impact publicly and in sort of perception and discussion with companies was related to the issue of apartheid in South Africa. So there was a group of sort of vocal investors of this type who wanted to influence companies who were operating in South Africa and supporting the apartheid regime there. And from there, you know, if we gallop very quickly forward, you know, there starts to become a expansion of the idea that environmental and social issues are relevant solely from an ethical or moral perspective, and only for those investors who want to align their portfolio with their beliefs and ethical preferences, to a much more nuanced and comprehensive sort of view and understanding of corporate risk and opportunity that fits very sort of neatly within sort of mainstream conceptions of how we should analyze companies and the challenges that they face in, you know, a changing world, you know, environmental challenges, social challenges, supply and demand challenges that fit very much under ENS umbrellas. Governance, we can sort of come back to. I think that's something that sort of interestingly got combined with the E and the S aspects here. But that sort of evolution over time, and something that, to be clear, is not complete yet. You know, there's still a lot of work being done. Took ESG investing from something that was driven by, you know, kind of moral preferences to, you know, very sound and well-defined investment beliefs.
Sure. And so I'd love to get into the three components specifically, and then maybe try to unpack some of the concepts you just discussed a bit more, because I think once we start drilling into what sorts of companies do and don't show up in these portfolios, I think it will raise some interesting questions around the sorts of issues that you just discussed. But before we dive deeper in, I'd love to just drill into the E, the S, and the G. So first of all, you guys have amazing graphics on FTSE Russell on your website, FTSERussell.com. There's a great one on sustainability and ESG data and the way that you put your ratings together. There's a great graphic here that lays out what sorts of things go into environmental, social, and governance. I'll include it in the accompanying article. But if you could just kind of take listeners through that, starting with the E, environmental, what sort of things is an indexer like FTSE Russell looking for when building an index that looks for companies that have positive environmental characteristics or a positive footprint in that area?
So we're going to look at things like water use, biodiversity, climate change, and how a company manages its pollution impact, not just of its own operations, but in its supply chain as well. Now, there's a very important distinction, though, to be made around sort of what we look at there, what we would describe as sort of themes as part of the environmental assessment in our ratings methodology. And that is to say, here we are looking at, you know, these questions, these dimensions of a company's impact on the environment through the lens of its operational footprint. Okay. We often talk about sort of, there's two ways you can think about, you know, environmental and social impacts of a company: the impact of its products or the impact of its sort of operational impact or conduct, we might say, right? So an easy sort of thought experiment here would be, you know, you can think of a company that makes electric vehicles or solar panels, right? Now, those products have a very positive environmental impact in their use in the market post-production once they're in the consumer's hands. However, the way in which those products are manufactured may or may not be very environmentally sound. So for our ESG ratings in particular, we are looking very much at the production side of the operational impacts and management of the environmental risks related to the production of those products. There's separate data that we'll look at that maybe looks at the product in the market and whether it has positive or negative environmental and social consequences. All those things come together when you talk about specific index methodologies. But really at this stage, what we're trying to understand is, from an E and S perspective and a G perspective, how do we look at a company's impact, really kind of a risk management profile, and how well are they managing those risks?
In terms of the environmental side of things, I'm just taking a look at the sector breakdowns of the two Vanguard funds that we'll get into in more detail later, which are which follow FTSE ESG indexes. It's the Vanguard ESG US Stock ETF ESGV, Vanguard ESG International Stock ETF VSGX, and the energy components in both of these funds are essentially non-existent. Is it safe to say that based on just a simple look at the impact of energy companies, that because they are just still so heavily reliant on fossil fuels, that they essentially will not end up in ESG portfolios?
Not necessarily in all cases. So for the two funds that you mentioned, track indices that FTSE Russell calculates called the FTSE Global Choice Index Family. And there we have exclusions sort of at a sector level and at a sort of product ownership level or involvement level rather, that are focused on fossil fuels. So, you know, you're right, the fossil fuel sector is largely non-existent in those portfolios. Because we are, by definition, excluding any company who owns oil and gas reserves or is involved in midstream and downstream activities related to fossil fuels. Now, that gets back to my point around the distinction between a company's products and its operations. So there, we're not really looking at and rating companies for, you know, how well those oil and gas companies, for example, manage environmental risks and impacts in their, you know, production of fossil fuels. We're just sort of looking at the product itself and saying, this is a portfolio of a methodology, an index rather, we're focused on the index here, you know, that excludes fossil fuels, full stop. So in that sense, you know, we will have ratings on all these companies that look at, you know, how well or not they're managing environmental risks and impact. But for some indexes, we don't need to use the rating because there's a full exclusion for the product or sector in question.
That makes sense. And I do wonder at some point if maybe one of the oil majors, an Exxon or a Chevron or whoever, finally gets to a place where the vast majority of what they're doing is actually with renewable energy sources. And that will happen at some point. I don't know if it's, you know, 20 or 100 years down the road, and who knows if those specific companies will even be there. I assume at that stage, even within the indexes that you mentioned, companies that were traditional energy, oil and gas companies would be eligible for inclusion at that point.
Yeah, that's right. Indexes will take any number of approaches to looking at this kind of question, but you're right, there will certainly be some where, you know, those oil and gas companies, to follow on this example, who are more aligned with a carbon constrained future, whether that's, you know, as you describe, sort of changing their business mix away from fossil fuels and more towards renewables, at some point during that transition, that will be reflected in the indexes that, you know, sort of rate and include companies on that basis. Now, the way that that may be reflected could be as a matter of, you know, now they're eligible to come into the index where they weren't before, or in some cases, other indexes take a more sort of nuanced approach where we're, you know, simply reweighting or adjusting exposure to those oil and gas companies on the basis of their transition readiness, as we would describe it, that transition to a low carbon economy. So those companies, you would start to see their allocation within the index start to increase over time. The challenge here is, I think we're sort of touching on in a few of these answers, is when it comes to ESG analysis, you have, as I sort of oversimplify it, you know, ingredients and recipes. The ingredients are the data, the things like our ratings or the things like how we assess where a company has its fossil fuel reserves exposure. The indexes are the recipe where we put those different things together. And there's a variety of recipes. So there's a lot of different potential outcomes depending on the strategy in question and the index in question. Some are much more aggressive and want to exclude certain, you know, sectors full stop. Others are far more nuanced and want to have broad exposure, but make sure that that broad exposure is done in a way that minimizes exposure to sort of the, you know, less well-rated companies and increases exposure to the better rated companies.
Interesting. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, actually. Moving over to the social side of things here, what sorts of components is FTSE Russell looking for when building the social part of these indexes?
So I think there, to go back to the question of a distinction between products and operations. On the product side, traditional sort of analysis will be focused on things like weapons and tobacco, other sin stocks. And again, a number of investors, particularly in the retail segment and users of ETF products, are looking to apply often those types of exclusions to their funds, kind of full stop, right? So maybe, X tobacco, X guns, whatever it might be. When we sort of turn our attention more to the operational impact and kind of looking at sort of risk management, if you will, of social issues, there we're going to look at things like, okay, if you're, say, a tobacco or an alcohol production company, well, what's the way in which that you actually make those products? How are your marketing standards? And are you a sort of a responsible producer of, what are legal products? We'll also sort of look at in other areas, things like human rights, labor standards, very important, both for own operations as well as for supply chains. Now, when you get into some of those questions, you introduce a geographical dimension to the conversation. So when we try and distinguish certain risk profiles amongst companies, and bear in mind, as an index provider, we're looking at thousands and thousands of companies globally here. In order to distinguish between sort of higher or lower risk profiles for social issues like human rights, labor standards, supply chain labor issues, we're going to look at not only certain sectors. So for example, in the supply chain, we're going to look at, food producers, textiles, but ICT as well. And we're also going to do that with an overlay of geographical sort of footprint. Where do you operate and where do your suppliers operate? Do you have exposure and operations in countries where the legal protections for labor standards are weaker? And if that's the case, if in effect sort of those two things are true, you operate in a high-risk sector and you operate in a high-risk country, then we're going to sort of holds you to a higher standard of analysis and sort of rating and kind of expectation that you are doing a better and more thorough job of managing that risk.
Sure. So it wouldn't be an automatic exclusion, but you would want to be sure that these companies were not simply doing the bare minimum required by that country, but were actually holding a much higher standard in terms of labor standards and protection of workers and all of those very important social components.
That's right. And I think that touches on a really important point when it comes to any kind of analysis and rating on ESG. This is still a very new area. It feels like, obviously it's very topical. And I do think that this is, now a firmly established investment practice that is sort of not going anywhere. However, we're still at early stages. And where that's relevant is that, standards and definitions in this area are, non-uniform. So when we're trying to assess, supply chain labor standard practices, there's no one set of guidelines that's, sort of universally accepted. But there are things that are close, and we try to use those so that companies are familiar with the standards that we're assessing because they're already practices that they're used to. In the case of supply chain labor standards, this is the International Labor Organization's core labor principles, things like prohibiting child and slave labor, the right to collectively bargain, right to freedom of association, et cetera, that companies are familiar with these standards. We're going to try and replicate our assessment process on existing international norms, not just for things like labor standards, but across the spectrum of ESG practices. So in that way, we're not just sort of, making up what we think is best practice. We're using what is already, existing.
Sure. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense to take kinds of treaties or things that other world governance bodies like the United Nations have already put into place. Now, just to stay on the social issue, so just looking under the hood of ESGV, which is, again, the Vanguard ESG US Stock ETF, which tracks the FTSE US All Cap Choice Index, I'm seeing here that, for example, Facebook is the fifth holding. Now, not to beat up on Facebook, because it seems like everybody does try and do that these days. But in terms of the use of the platform in particular, and maybe their lack of responsiveness for example, some of the massacres that happened to the Rohingya people in Myanmar, maybe even some of the challenges to the electoral process in places like the US and Europe. How is it that a company like Facebook, and then I guess you can throw all the privacy issues on top of that, and certainly a lot of people have been leaving WhatsApp recently and moving over to platforms like Signal and Telegram because of those consumer privacy issues. So I'm just wondering what the analysis is like there on a company like that, and what it would take for them to be, if not excluded, at least weighted less than a, you know, top five holding in this kind of an index.
Sure. And I think this brings up sort of a third area of analysis, in this realm, which is what we would describe as kind of controversial conduct. So we've talked a little bit about sort of product impact, right? So does a company produce certain products that we want to remove exposure to? You can see how that would be, you know, it's more complex than what I would sort of suggest most people think it is, but it's fairly straightforward and objective. You either do or you don't produce the thing in question, and we just need to find the evidence of that in the public domain. The second category we talked about is kind of, you know, company conduct based on kind of risk management of operational impact. Now, the examples that you're giving here don't necessarily fit in either of those, so you can see how companies, you know, may pass certain criteria there. So we're going to look at a third area, which is kind of controversial conduct. In a way, another way to sort of think about this is almost like headline risk in a way. Are you, you know, despite your policies, your management systems, and sort of public reporting on how you're looking at all of these ESG operational risks, there's still things that are happening in the field that are, you know, negatively impactful and controversial and sort of representing reputational, legal, or financial risk to the company. Now, I think this is an area that is actually very sort of challenging to assess at scale. Its reliance on third-party sort of data, often media sources, and trying to sort of scrutinize those, which requires a lot of sort of AI-driven and big data techniques to sort of derive, you know, kind of sentiment type analysis at a huge scale from sort of effectively, you know, global media sources every day to see what's happening out there and sort of where do some of these risks lie. But it also presents a challenge of, you know, trying to define what are standards that sort of do or don't pass certain criteria. And I think we've gotten very strong at looking at sort of traditional sort of incidents of corporate controversies, like, you know, an environmental disaster, like an oil spill or something like that, right? That you can point to as a singular event that happened on a day and had specific environmental or health and safety consequences. Similarly, you can look at sort of corruption or accounting scandals and sort of make similar assessments, even though there isn't necessarily a one-day point in time sort of that the thing happened. But the kind of challenges presented by a lot of sort of larger tech and social media companies now in relation to this controversial conduct piece is something that I think, you know, realistically as an industry, we're all sort of trying to sort of wrestle with and address. I think something that is going to be important to sort of, you know, continue to evolve is standards for how we would look at, you know, where some of the company practices or actions have had, you know, sort of an impact that would fall foul of the criteria. Now, today, that hasn't been the case in, you know, a lot of the indexes that we use and some of the controversy ratings that we develop. But as some of those efforts to address the company practices, whether they be sort of regulatory, legal, shareholder-driven, consumer-driven, start to bite, then you could see that change.
Sure, it makes sense. And I do think one thing that you said there, I think is worth noting, and that is you're talking about using AIs because this it has to be quantitative in some way, because you're talking about a rules-based index. And so if you start introducing too much of a qualitative analysis element there, so then it's basically just a person or a committee's opinions on how serious a particular breach is, whether it's really kind of a central feature of a company or just something that maybe happened as a one-off. And I think it becomes difficult to run a rules-based index if you're constantly reacting to the news cycle, which in and of itself can be problematic obviously. So definitely interesting to hear how this will evolve, because I think it's a conversation that needs to be had, but it doesn't sound like there's any very easy solutions at this stage.
Indeed.
So moving over to the governance side of this, and you had hinted at this at first. First of all, what is this and what's it doing in this bucket here of ESG?
Yeah, I mean, I think governance sort of in a traditional boardroom governance sense is something that's been, you know, part and parcel of sort of mainstream investment management for a lot longer than sort of ESG has been around. I think at some point, you know, in the last sort of couple decades, this acronym got put together, you know, as a way to kind of combine things that sort of at the time I recall being described as kind of non-financial risks. I think we've kind of moved away from that terminology as an industry because there's clearly financial implications in all of these dimensions. But what I think it kind of gets at, you know, why these sort of ESG were put together in my opinion is that, you know, there's sort of an underlying implicit understanding or expression of intangible value here that is, you know, we're all familiar with, even if we're not explicit in sort of talking about it and understanding, right? So the share of intangible value relative to sort of the physical or balance sheet value of a company, if you just look at any sort of large US benchmark, has shifted dramatically over the last sort of 2-3 decades, right? So, you know, the market capitalization of some of the largest companies in the world are, you know, massively comprised of intangible value. And kind of the idea then that sort of where there was a governance function that looked at boardroom governance and tried to translate that into some sort of like risk and intangible value for the company sort of fit in my mind a little bit neatly with kind of these concepts of, well, how do we measure, you know, kind of environmental and social risk as well? Let's put it all together. Now, in our approach, when we talk about sort of governance type ratings, it isn't just boardroom governance. We're also going to expand that concept to look at things like corruption practices, anti-corruption practices, I should say. Mm-hmm. We're going to look at risk management in sort of a broader context as well, and tax transparency. That sort of all fit underneath kind of this governance umbrella, as well as traditional boardroom governance.
Do things like diversity in the boardroom fall into this category as well? So is there any attempt to, let's say, maybe overweight companies that have gone out of their way to put more women in positions of leadership or more minorities, or does that not really fall into the ESG bucket at all?
No, that's right, and that's kind of where this fits traditionally is sort of within the corporate governance piece of the equation. You know, as is often the case when doing this type of analysis, it's kind of that next level of, okay, well, how are we actually going to measure this kind of thinking that has to be nailed down before you can sort of execute it and build it into a rating. So, for example, when looking at women on board as you know, one case, there are varying sort of regional standards and practices that we would want to account for in that to make sure that, you know, what we're reflecting is not sort of specific to sort of one idealized global standard. We want to be reflective right. of what, you know, peer practices are so that, you know, in line with sort of an overall objective to be what we would describe as, I think sort of, you know, challenging, but not, you know, unrealistic, so that, you know, a particular practice in one country in terms of number of women on the board doesn't always get the same rating as in a different country.
Sure, that makes sense. And just the tax transparency thing kind of sticks out to me here again, because we're looking at companies like Apple and Amazon who have notoriously, I suppose they're transparent about it, but despite their just incredible earnings every single quarter, they notoriously gotten out of paying pretty much all taxes. And so I guess that kind of pushes the tax burden onto you and I and the little guy, when a company like Apple or Amazon pays, you know, 1% of its earnings in taxes. So just curious if you could drill into that a little more, the tax transparency thing. You're not necessarily talking about companies that are claiming all their IP comes from like Ireland or some tax sheltered company. Is this some other definition there?
Yeah, so transparency is the key word there. And you sort of picked up on that, I think, in your question as well. So this is emblematic of kind of a wider sort of challenge when it comes to, you know, ESG assessments and ratings. All of these company ratings and assessments are driven to a very large degree, and in the case of FTSE Russell, 100%, by publicly available information that companies report. So their annual reports, their company websites, and sustainability reports in some cases where companies publish those. Now, that information is essentially not regulated and certainly not regulated uniformly in a global manner. So there's often this sort of emphasis from our perspective on, you know, more better data, which means we're not trying to be prescriptive about what is or isn't a good outcome, but we want to have transparency into your practices. What is your thinking of sort of the risk at hand? Is there a sort of recognition and understanding of the risk in question? Is there a management system to sort of properly to manage that risk? And are you reporting on the outcomes of that process? So, you know, whether it's something like tax transparency or something like carbon emissions, there isn't necessarily a prescriptive, and here's what the number should be, you know, at the end of the day, right? Like, what is a good tax bill to have, or what is a good carbon emissions profile to have? It's more about, are you being open and transparent with the fact that, A, this is, you know, information that shareholders and other stakeholders should have because it presents value. Two, you've got there in a thorough way that has a, you know, robust management system behind it. And three is sort of embedded in sort of a, you know, corporate-wide understanding of the strategic issue and risk and opportunity inherent in the question, which is why you're going through this whole process. You know, that oftentimes then leads us to a situation where, you know, disclosure and better information is kind of one key outcome we can point to as sort of what is driving improvements in company practices, and where you want to be even more aggressive and look at, you know, no, you know, maybe if some of our clients do have a particular view on what a good carbon emissions outcome looks like, or what a good tax transparency outcome looks like, then we have the ability to reflect that in specific index methodology. So again, coming back to that concept of, you know, we have ratings and data which serve as the ingredients, and then we have indexes that serve as the recipes. And depending on a client's preference, you can, you know, apply those ingredients in a very restrictive way or in a more nuanced way.
Sure. And so I think this touches on how FTSE Russell goes from gathering and compiling the ratings, making sure that they're accurate, to actually constructing indexes that are based on them. How do you ensure the accuracy of the data that powers these ratings? What sorts of sources are being used? And because, again, everything really does come down to the data here. So if the data was corrupted in some way, there would be specific companies that were either omitted from indexes or that were included when they shouldn't have been. So what sorts of sources actually powering the data here?
Yeah, so publicly available information is the key driver here. And for something like our ratings, as well as when we look at sort of the product involvement type research that we described around whether you're a tobacco company or weapons company, et cetera, you know, that is all driven by company disclosure. So annual report, 10K filings, company websites, sustainability reports. The controversial conduct piece we talked about in reference to some of the social media companies or headline risk type analysis, that will be driven by some third-party analysis, mostly media sources that we're trying to scrutinize. But when we're looking at company disclosure, and again, bear in mind, we're doing this for around 7,000 odd companies globally, right? Yeah. So we have an army of people doing this and a massive technology platform that enables those people to sort of be more than just sort of, you know, analysts making an opinion. We want to give them rules and methodologies that are defined that they need to follow based on, you know, the specific disclosure that we can find in the public domain. Now, does that mean that all of the information that is provided by companies has been sort of independently verified by us or someone else? No, not necessarily. As I mentioned, sort of corporate disclosure around, you know, E and S topics in particular are not regulatory requirements really to any significant degree in any environment, you know, in any country. So there are some stock exchanges that have listing requirements in this regard, but they're often guidelines. And the requirements that do exist in some places are, you know, often about specific data points or elements, whether it's about diversity or carbon emissions or something like that. In our model, we're looking at over 300 different data points. So, you know, there is, you know, a reliance on sort of company disclosure and data, which is getting better and better all the time. You know, over the 16 years I've been doing this, I always say it's always getting better, and it's still not where it needs to be, right? But there is that fundamental sort of nature of the underlying information at hand. And I think that actually has a lot to do with why, you know, certain segments of the investor community are sort of sometimes just sort of wrestle with ESG in general, because it's not the same as just taking, you know, information from a balance sheet and numbers, you know, that are, you know, required regulatory filings and sort of measurable outputs of company practice and structure. Here we are trying to, you know, assess company practices that are in many cases qualitative and translate those into quantitative outputs. And we're doing so on the basis of information that comes directly from the company that is sort of the main driver of what we then know to be the best source of analysis to use.
Sure. It makes a lot of sense. I mean, there really are value judgments being made here, which I think if you agree, for example, that we're kind of screwing up the planet, then or, you know, that there are just certain behaviors taking place towards employees or laborers of the company that are simply unacceptable, then, you know, it makes sense. But at the end of the day, I suppose there are many people that maybe would quibble with some of those points. And so it becomes difficult for them to maybe buy into the entire project as a result of it. I'd love to get into, particularly with the two indexes that we've been discussing, and I think these are good indexes to discuss for the audience in particular, because they're very easily accessible to US-based investors. So we're talking again about the Vanguard ESG US Stock ETF, and that is tracking the FTSE US All Cap Choice Index, expense ratio of just 12 basis points. So you're really not being penalized on the expense side to get access to that FTSE index. And then Vanguard ESG International Stock ETF, ticker symbol VSGX, which tracks the FTSE Global All Cap XUS Choice Index, that has an expense ratio of just 15 basis points. So you have your, as you said, you have ingredients and then you have actual recipes. You're looking at more than 300 different things. I'm going to go out on a limb and assume you're not equally weighting every single one of those 300 components. How do you get from that analysis and those 300 different components into an actual index that both selects particular names, omits other ones, and then weights those names within the index?
Yeah, so that is a very involved question. So I'm going to do my best to sort of talk through, because it is a complex process. But
sure, and you can keep it relatively high level, just so people kind of understand. There's a long list of things here. They're not all treated equally necessarily.
That's exactly right. So, you know, companies all have different sort of risk profiles when we look at ESG issues, depending on what they do, where they operate. And then in the case of a specific index, you know, similarly, there will be a different objective in terms of what the indexes are trying to accomplish. Now, for the FTSE Global Choice Indexes, which are the benchmarks used in the ETFs you referenced, the objective here is to really incorporate particularly environmental and social impacts of a company's products and a company's conduct, and removing exposure to certain companies based on that analysis. In particularly, we're going to focus on product-related exposures in a few different areas. One is fossil fuels. The other is traditional sin stocks, like tobacco, gambling, alcohol.
And then we're also going to remove weapons companies. So both, you know, kind of civilian firearms as well as military weapons and a particular segment of military weapons that are, you know, more indiscriminate in their use.
Sure. Just out of curiosity, while you're on the sin stock topic, just I'm sure something that'll be of interest to investors in the market right now. So you mentioned alcohol. Would cannabis stocks also fall into that category, or are they not treated in the same way as alcohol makers are?
They are treated in the same way.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the legality of these things in the country that a company is based in has no bearing on that, I suppose.
That's right. I mean, this is about sort of, you know, client preferences, right? Rather than, you know, any, you know, so alcohol and tobacco in this case and gambling are screens that we apply to the index. So we're removing companies that have involvement in those activities. Cannabis is the same. And, you know, what we're trying to align with here is, you know, the challenge of ESG, which is sort of consensus, right? If you get 11 individuals or 11 investment institutions in a room and ask them, you know, what are your opinions on, you know, this stock, that stock, et cetera, you may get, you know, more than 11 different answers. So there's a challenge of consensus and scalability here. I think our approach for these indexes, the Global Choice Indexes, is to make sure that we're casting a wide net around sort of product exclusions, so that there isn't necessarily something left on the outside. You go, well, you exclude this, but why not that? So we're excluding a range of activities, which I just kind of summarized. And that really drives a large portion of the index construction. And indeed, we talked a little bit about the sector exposures. So, you know, the lack of oil and gas exposure, for example, is driven by that fossil fuel screen. We do also look at sort of company conduct and that controversial sort of conduct piece that we talked about before. And we do look at diversity practices as well. Related to that for the Global Choice Indexes. But the result is that we effectively screen out companies who don't pass those criteria. And then the remaining companies are market cap weighted. So there's no reweighting involved here. And the resulting, you know, index for both the U.S. All Cap Choice Index and the Global XUS All Cap Choice Index have both performed pretty well over the last few years, I think both outperforming over the last 3 years relative to the benchmark.
And what is the benchmark on these funds, just out of curiosity?
So it's the, you know, underlying market cap weighted version of the index. So in the case of the USA All Cap Choice Index, it is just the USA All Cap Index. So it's a large, mid and small cap segment of the US market. And then for the Global XUS, it's large, mid, small cap for emerging and developed markets, ex-US.
Okay, sure. Yeah, it makes sense. And I guess getting into the performance side of things, because this is definitely an issue that you see people bring up. They say, I'm all for ESG strategies, but not if it means that I'll retire with, you know, $500,000 less or something. What is the performance record to date in this space? Of course, this is kind of a broad question. It obviously depends on the index and the benchmark and the methodology. But do you feel that this is a valid concern, or is this just kind of much ado about nothing in terms of longer term performance?
I mean, I think performance is always a valid concern, but I think what, you know, what we've moved past is the misperception that there's a performance penalty by definition with incorporating ESG into your investment strategy. That just has been proven not to be the case. So when we look at our indexes, we see a few things. One is, as I described for kind of the Global Choice Indexes, which are the basis for these ETFs, they have outperformed over the last 3 years. We also see, you know, increasing demand for indexes that are by design delivering benchmark-like returns. So explicitly trying to mimic the performance of the underlying index rather than deliver outperformance, right? So in effect, a replacement of beta exposure from just the standard index to an ESG reweighted index, but that still looks and feels like the underlying index. And can serve as the same sort of portfolio building block because of that. So, you know, for a lot of clients, particularly in the institutional space, but increasingly for ETFs as well, we are seeing, you know, kind of a shift in preference from, oh, I'm interested in ESG and I want to see how much outperformance I can get as well, to actually, I want, you know, sort of benchmark-like returns with ESG baked in.
Sure. And then beyond equities, there's been more and more discussion about ESG being applied to fixed income and other sorts of strategies. What can you say about ESG beyond equities?
A couple of things. One is it's a little bit further behind, but in part that is because of the underlying data, particularly from private entities, is even more challenging to deal with, right? So, you know, compiling a rating, as we talked about, is challenging based on sort of the quality and quantity of corporate disclosure that's provided. That's for listed companies. When you start to look at private companies, it becomes even more challenging. The other thing is, I think there's, you know, been, and we talked about this with sort of some of the history and roots of social responsible investing and how that related to ESG. You know, engagement and stewardship by sort of end, you know, by investors trying to influence company practices through shareholder action is part of a lot of ESG strategies. And that's not as common in, you know, in fixed income portfolios. And I think another area is that, you know, there's a huge chunk of, you know, fixed income portfolios that are not related to corporate credit, right? So now we're talking about assessing different entities altogether. And, you know, ESG analysis may be easier or sort of more or less appropriate for some of those. So for example, we're doing a lot of work with our colleagues at a firm called Beyond Ratings, which we acquired a few years ago, looking at sovereign climate risk and trying to deliver benchmarks for, you know, sovereign bond investors that, you know, are reflective of country climate change risk management practices, and starting to reweight those government bond indexes to be more reflective of companies' climate change practices. And I think that's sort of, you know, an example of kind of innovation in this space that is, you know, going to take some time to catch on.
We are starting to see some bond ETFs actually get out to market with ESG marking. So this is definitely something which is starting to actually be practical for both institutional and retail investors. So definitely good to see that trend unfolding. And then broadly speaking, what are you seeing in terms of growing adoption of ESG investing? Clearly, Europe is ahead of the US here. What are you seeing in terms of growing adoption in the US? And then globally as a trend, where do you feel things are right now? And how big do you think this can actually get?
Yeah. So, I mean, in the US, it is certainly exploding. And that sort of gap between Europe and the US, in my opinion, is closing. So there's a few ways that we can look at that. You know, one, certainly on the institutional side, we survey a global group of asset owners every year about a range of topics, including sustainable investment. The last iteration showed demand and interest in sustainable investing on par with Europe for the US. If we switch to retail a little bit and sort of look at, you know, some of the latest information on fund flows from Morningstar, you know, basically Q4 last year was another record-breaking quarter in terms of flows, assets, product launches. Yes, Europe accounted for the bulk of that, but the US set records as well. And there's an interesting sort of under the waterline shift happening there when we talk about sort of fund assets and product launches, which is that a huge number of funds are being kind of repurposed or rebranded into sustainable funds. And I think there's, you know, that's a very telling sign. On the one hand, if you wanted to be cynical about it, you could say, oh, it's just a rebranding exercise. Be careful of greenwashing. But I would, you know, be a little bit more optimistic about that and to say, actually, you know, the point of a lot of ESG investing in general is not to remake the investment process and say, this is the only thing that should determine that what goes into your portfolios. For a lot of investors, particularly, you know, those with you know, sort of large existing fund product lineups, It's about incorporating more information into your investment decision-making. You know, don't willfully exclude environmental and social and governance issues from your decision-making process. You have to be proactive in how you think about and incorporate these things. And I think once you do that, it's perfectly legitimate to then sort of, you know, reposition or talk about your funds as aligned with ESG practices or sustainability standards. Now, having said that, a lot of fund launches are very specifically dedicated to ESG and sustainability outcomes. For us, a big focus lately in that realm has been related to climate change and environmentally thematic products. So there's a huge amount of demand, particularly from asset owners in Europe, but increasingly in the US as well, where there's sort of two things that they want. They want to align their portfolios with kind of a 2-degree or sort of, 1-degree scenario, by which I mean, you know, recognizing there's going to be carbon constraints in the world in the decades to come. So how do we reweight our portfolios to companies that are better prepared for that future? And crucially, how do we make those portfolios still serve as the bedrock of, you know, what today are our core passive building blocks? So we want a risk return profile that, you know, looks and feels like the benchmark today. We're able to do that. And we've had a lot of success in developing climate transition indexes as we talk about them to help meet that need. I would expect over time that kind of demand to translate into the ETF market as well, where you can say, here is, you know, a realistic climate future oriented scenario built into an index where we're reweighting companies who are best prepared for that, underweighting those that aren't. And look, the risk return is still like what you're used to getting in a traditional broad market index.
Sure. And I do actually think it's a service for existing funds and fund issuers to change the scope of what they're doing to include these various facets, the ESG facets in existing funds. Because if you think about it, if you have an awakening or you realize, you know, that this is an important place to be allocating your money, but for example, you already have 20, 30 years of gains built up in a non-tax deferred account, it can be quite financially prohibitive to suddenly sell off your fund, trigger all these massive gain events, and then shift your things into a fund which is more ESG friendly. So by taking existing funds and moving in that direction, I think it does make shareholders' lives much easier and prevents them having to make that tough decision of, my heart is in this, but I don't really want to pay, a ton in capital gains taxes by switching out of a fund that's done very well until now. So definitely good that the fund issuers are thinking along those lines. Anyway, Tony, I want to thank you for being so generous with your time today. I found this to be really just a fascinating conversation and one I definitely want to keep on having on this show. Where should investors go to continue to research everything we've been discussing here today?
Well, we put a lot of content on FTSERussell.com and on Twitter as well. You can connect with me on LinkedIn. My name is Tony Campos. And, you know, stay up to date with what your global and regional organizations dedicated to sustainable investment are doing. So globally, there's an organization called the PRI, the Principles for Responsible Investment. And here in the US, there's an organization called USCIF, SIF, which is dedicated to sustainable investment and finance. So those are great resources for anybody.
Definitely feels like a new dawn in terms of new administration, new Congress, which I think will be considerably more focused on many of the ideals represented by ESG investing. So definitely going to be interesting to see how this space continues to evolve over the next 4 years and beyond.
Absolutely. Thanks, Jonathan. It's been great talking with you.
For disclosures, neither Tony Campos nor myself, Jonathan Liss, hold positions in any of the funds or stocks mentioned in today's show.
If you've been enjoying Let's Talk ETFs, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. And if you find this podcast useful, please consider leaving a review on one of those platforms so that other investors can discover it. You can also find this podcast on seekingalpha.com by typing Let's Talk ETFs into the search bar at the top of the site.